Welcome to Nerdist Podcast number 563, At Midnight returns on the 26th of August. I don't know why my voice is so dramatic. It feels like we've been gone for a long time. It's only been a couple weeks, but we'll be back. And then we'll be back on for a really long time because we got picked up. So we'll be on through at least through the end of 2015. So watch the show, I guess. I don't even know if I'm really promoting anything. I'm just saying we'll be back next week, which is Chris D'Elia, who was on At Midnight not that long ago. And he did a fantastic job, you guys. He's going to be on the Oddball Festival, which I'm also on. And we're going to be doing a handful of the dates together. And his own tour, Under No Influence, which starts in September. Go to chrisdelia.com, D-E-L-I-A, for all the tour dates. And here's the Nerdist Podcast number 563 with the aforementioned Chris D'Elia.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
We did?
That was it.
Oh, okay. How do you feel? Do you feel like it started?
Good. Yeah. No, I feel like it's starting already. I got to catch up.
Okay. Is there another way that you would prefer to start?
No, I would like to start like that.
Okay.
Because then it feels more natural.
Okay, good.
If you're like, hey, ladies and gentlemen, here we go. And there's like, dun, 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 dun.
You've seen him at clubs and colleges. Where do you think the clubs and colleges thing started?
Before TV.
Well, just for most people who don't know, that's sort of like, when an MC doesn't know much about the performer he's about to introduce at a show, it's you've seen him at clubs and colleges.
Because they can bank on at least they have that as a credit.
Right. You've been in clubs because you're in a club.
Right.
And
this isn't your first time doing stand-up.
There's a good chance it's not your first time doing stand-up. Right. And if you've had any length of a – you probably have – well, and also there's a good chance you just went to college.
Yeah, they don't say you've seen him perform at clubs and colleges. Mm-hmm. They just say you've seen him at clubs and colleges.
You've seen him hanging around clubs and colleges.
That's pretty much 90% of people, really.
So anyone from the audience could be introduced as...
Yeah, you've seen him at clubs. Well, you've definitely seen anybody in the audience, you've seen them at clubs because they're out.
They're there when they're right now, yeah. And then, but colleges is a little, but there's a good chance.
Even if you didn't go to college, you've been to a college.
You might have been to, or just driven at least near a junior college.
Right, counts.
Yeah, and if someone was staring at the junior college and you drove by, it's like, well, that technically counts as being at a college.
Yeah.
So it works on a lot of levels. I think actually just the one level, but.
The one level, that's what matters. The one level.
As long as there's a level, then it totally works. But welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, man.
Officially. Where are you? I don't know that much about you, Chris. I just know that... how long have you been in Los Angeles?
I've been in Los Angeles for, 22 years. I moved when I was 12.
Okay.
So, with my family, my dad and my mom, not my kids. I didn't have kids at 12.
You didn't have kids at 12?
No.
That you know about. I mean,
right.
Come on, it's Los Angeles, man.
I know, dude.
It can happen.
No, I moved with my mom, my dad, my brother, when I was 12, and then I feel like I'm from LA, though.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, occasionally people will be like, "You have an accent. Where are you from?" And I'll say New Jersey, but I feel like I grew up out here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've been here for well over 20 years, and I've realized that this is the most I've lived anywhere. So I'm pretty much just from here.
I know. Well, yeah, because I used to be like, well, I lived half my life on the East Coast and half my life on the West Coast, but that was when I was 24.
Yeah. Yeah, and then and the longer 34. You're here, then the more...
Yeah, not half and half.
So it's you can't really say that anymore.
And I don't want to be like, yeah, two-thirds of my life I live on the West Coast, and then one-third, and I just sound like a math geek.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, technically, 66.6%.
Right.
I mean, like you could actually calculate,
right.
And each day it would change
a little bit.
Yeah.
Very long numbers, 6755525%.
And then people would be like, oh, you got to go ask him today because it's going to be a different number.
I would hate keeping up with that.
But
I'd also be wrong a lot.
You know what? It doesn't matter. As long as you commit to it, it's worth the story.
That's true.
Yeah. So you went to high school out here then?
Yeah, I did.
Where'd you go?
La Cañada High School.
Oh, La Cañada. La Cañada is a very fancy part of Los Angeles near, I used to spend a lot of time in La Crescenta.
Right, the less fancy version.
The less fancy version of the foothills.
Right.
And La Cañada is super snaz. I went to Loyola for a year.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, because my family moved out here when I was in high school.
Whoa, all right. I didn't know that.
Yeah, so I've been here, and then I just stayed.
My buddies went to Loyola. Yeah, we had... That was an all-boys school, right?
It still is.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know.
Yep. Still is. All-boys school. They, which I didn't mind, actually, because I was awkward around girls.
Anyway. Oh, yeah. Well, there was them, and then the Sacred Heart was the girls'
Immaculate
school.
Heart.
Right?
Is there a Sacred Heart,
there
too?
There was a Sacred Heart. Yeah, I don't know what's
going on. There's an Immaculate Heart, and then there's a Notre Dame, which was all girls, but then I think went co-ed.
Oh, okay.
But Loyola is still just dudes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really like La Cañada. I mean, it's one of those places that, you know, when you go there, you're like, yeah, it's really nice here. It's very far from everything else that you would have to do on a day-to-day basis. But, you know, because you just get on the 2 and just start driving.
Yeah, it's very nice. It's like the only problem with it was that it was like clicky, which is a good thing. You know, who cares? It's like that. There was no real crime or anything like that. It was just a good place for a kid to grow up.
You know, this is going to alienate 98% of our audience, but you know what's
we
really...
We kind of already have.
Yeah, I guess that's true. what really turned the corner is Montrose got real nice.
That really did actually... You did make it less of a percentage that...
Well, Montrose used to be kind of you know, just a little dumpy.
Let me bring it back, though, so people will now relate to it a little bit. Montrose is used a lot in movies, and there was a scene in that movie Old School where Will Ferrell, he was in that? No.
Yeah.
He was in that where he was running down naked the street.
Frank the Tank.
That was shot in Montrose.
Oh, okay.
So
that should give everyone some context.
Now people have a reference.
Well, it used to just be a bunch of weird... what looked like elderly person clothing stores.
Absolutely.
And they've slowly been kind of edged out in favor of like nice restaurants.
Right.
And there's like a really
cool
bowling center there that is only available for like private parties.
And
like it's kind of turned into a
but
cool
they
area.
Absolutely still have those stores.
Yes.
And it's so weird to me I mean, I guess there are just enough people there that would buy those clothes.
Montrose is sort of like a version of Hill Valley in Back to the Future, where there's not like a town square, but there's a town street.
Right.
And so if you lived in any of that surrounding area, it would be very charming and quaint. You could just walk down and buy your multicolored scarf.
Right.
And then walk back to your home. It seems like a very safe neighborhood. It's near the hills of Glendale, in between Glendale and La Cañada. It's a nice area.
There was a place called Faye's there, which was FAYES, and it would sell multicolored scarves and like the one piece long dresses.
Mm-hmm.
And I would never I grew up around there. I never saw anybody in that store. But it wasn't
except for Faye.
Yeah, yeah. Even she was like, I'm not going.
Why would I go in there?
But it was like a drug front, but there, you knew it wasn't a drug front because it was a Montrose.
Oh my God, do you think Faye was the top of some weird coke
pyramid?
That'd
be very cool.
That would be amazing.
That'd be great.
And they found out, they started dusting the scarves and finding like all these traces of illegal substances.
Forensics came and found all this.
That would be
coke.
Amazing. Faye's badass. Where did you start doing comedy then?
In L.A.
Yeah.
Yeah, I started doing it in North Hollywood in the Ha Ha Cafe.
Kind of the... I remember when the Ha Ha opened where that was during the NoHo Arts District boom.
Yeah.
They were like, this is a complete shit area. Let's put some nice restaurants and try to get some people not murdered.
Right.
And so they kind of like spruced it up a bit. Now it's actually kind of a decent area of the valley.
Yeah. Yeah, it's nice. They got like nice apartment buildings and lofts and like so many dance studios. I think that's what makes it the arts. You just keep seeing people like dressed in like you see girls walking by in like really baggy sweats and like Kobe Bryant jerseys. And you're like the only... person who would do that is either Kobe Bryant or a dancer.
Next to the tap and Ha-Ha's the tap tap, and then everything's just
and phase.
It's two words.
Yeah,
but it. I don't think I ever actually performed at the Ha-Ha before.
Really?
What was the vibe of it?
Well, it's opening a new place now, like a block away, and I think they're gonna have both. And apparently, that's supposed to be like a great new club coming up. But, the old one, which is still the one that they use, is it's really... I mean, look, I started doing stand-up there, and I would do open mic every single night, and I loved it personally. It's definitely got like a charm to it where you're like, oh, I could... You know, who knows what could happen here, which is...
It sounds like you're excusing a drunk friend.
Well, yeah.
I mean, if you really... Yeah, I know he can be abrasive. But exactly. Honestly, he's loyal.
But, yeah, to be totally honest, that is what I'm doing. But that's what the Comedy Store is too, man. And that's my favorite place to perform. So it's like, I think if you're in a comedy club and you think, hey, somebody could definitely walk in here and set this place on fire while I'm watching comedy, literally.
Yeah.
Then it's a better show.
Well, and
I just personally think it's a better show that way.
It also, you know, I started doing comedy in very safe environments in terms of, like, you know, the alternative rooms, which were very safe because,
yeah, sure.
I mean, you're performing for the same people. And by the way, as much as I loved it, as much as I love the other comics and being in that particular community of comics, I don't think it's the best way to learn comedy because you're essentially performing for your friends. And
sure.
Comedy Store and places like the HaHa are that's much more trial by fire.
Yeah.
And so, but I definitely think it creates a different style of comedy.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it is. I mean, I've played both types of rooms, obviously, as you have, and, you know, all comics have, but it's there's something about the Comedy Store and the HaHa where it's like, you just feel like if this set goes bad, I could get beat up. You know what I mean? That's you definitely feel that.
You go up at 1:30 in the morning.
Yeah, the show's still going on then.
Are they still doing the was it Monday or Sunday nights, like 40 comics?
Comedy Store, yeah, they do it only on Mondays now. It was Sundays and Mondays.
It was like 40 comics, 3 minutes a person.
Yep. And then as the night got later, it got to 10 minutes, like for friends and family, and then regulars would come in and sometimes just work on stuff. But
I mean, I can't even imagine, like, I think about the comedy, like doing stand-up in those environments in, like, the late 70s or the early 80s, like, right when people did come out in droves to see.
They used to say, like, it was packed on Mondays. Like, it was overflowing on Mondays. It was overflowing on Tuesdays. It was overflowing. Like, I would love to see that, just even as an audience member, to see those comedians there doing that. Like, it's not like that. I mean, it's getting better, you know? Yeah. But when I first got there in 2007, 2008, nobody was there. Nobody was at the Comedy Store on Tuesday. It was like there were like 9 people in the audience. And that sucks. And that's where you think you'll get beat up.
Right. But how did they turn it around?
They got better. They got, I wouldn't say better comics, but they got comics. Comics started getting on TV again, really. You know, it's like if you look at there was a big thing that happened where it was like Friends made it so actors got on sitcoms and it was okay. And I think before that, it was a lot of comics on sitcoms.
Of course.
You know, and then when Friends worked, it was, one of the most successful shows of all time. So it was like I think comics kind of felt not obsolete, but in a way it was like, oh, well, that took the comedy out of it. You know, that took, not the comedy out of it, but that took the, oh, I got to go see that comedian away from people.
I never even thought about that. Yeah. But that also happens to coincide with the comedy bubble bursting in like 92.
Right.
When there was just a glut of comedy shows on television that all of a sudden people just got bored of.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I'm seeing the same people doing the same sets on 5 different shows.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then it went away.
And that's why now I think it's kind of, well, now for our show Undateable, we have 4 comics on it, you know? And even before that, Whitney, it was like people were a little, to see that on NBC again,
right?
You know, was definitely weird for people. I mean, we were on after The Office and people who were 14 were like, what is this?
Right.
Why are there people laughing?
Because it was much more of
this?
A traditional sitcom.
Yeah, which is, they're the biggest shows still, but it's like people don't, you know, Big Bang Theory, but on NBC, where you've got people who watch The Office, you've got people who watch Parks and Recreation, like, they didn't understand what was going on.
But the 4-camera sitcom, yes, some of those are the biggest shows, but there are not a lot of them anymore.
Right, right.
And it used to be, you know.
Well, it used to be the way comedies were made.
Right.
There were no, you know, Modern Family, really.
Right. And if there was a show like that, it was like on HBO or
right,
something.
Exactly,
it wasn't on network.
Not on network for sure.
But I think writing a sitcom now feels, I think it'd be a real pain in the ass to write a sitcom because you have, you know, 5-6 decades of sitcom jokes that have been,
right.
Like the waters have been.
Cause they are jokes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I guess the way that you get around that, I'm assuming, is like, well, you just got to focus on the characters and have the jokes come out of that, as opposed to just right. writing jokes that anyone could say.
Right. Yeah. It's, I mean, it is about story as well, but when you do multi-camera sitcom, the writers are trying to get as many jokes in a minute as possible, you know?
Right.
So.
And how's Undateable going?
It's going well. We just got picked up for the second season.
Congratulations.
A few days ago, yeah. So.
Boy, that's so much fun. You've been working pretty, I mean, you for the last few years, you've been going from thing to thing.
Yeah,
to thing.
I've been really fortunate, man. I did this show called Glory Days on TBS for a year. That got canceled. And then the next day I got Whitney, the next day. And then I did Whitney for 2 years. And then when that got canceled, the next week I got Undateable.
Wow.
So I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm tricking people. So.
I think you just have to enjoy that it's happening.
Yeah.
Because it is, you know, do you feel like, I'm doing it. This is the dream. This is what I wanted to do.
I have to stop and think about that. Yeah. Whenever somebody says, what do you want to do now in your life? I always think like, oh, I'm doing it.
Right.
You know, that's when I realize like, man, I'm being able to go on stage whenever I want. Cause that's what I love doing is doing stand up. Like mm-hmm. if I had to pick one, it would be that. But, yeah, I mean the TV stuff is great too, but that's like, that's that to me, that's great because that adds to stand up. People are like, oh, I've seen the show Undateable. Let's go see him do stand up. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I always think the same thing. Yeah. It's everything that I do on television, like I just hope it gets people out to stand up shows.
Yeah, that's me too. That's how I feel.
Because you can't perform to 9 people all the time and actually be able to sustain like over a long.
Right.
I mean, you have to do that when you're younger.
Yeah,
comic.
Of course,
you have to
of
learn
course.
How to do that. But
and every now and then it's fun to just pop in and do something like that, like on a show that's dead. You know.
But if you want a tour, it's
well, you don't want 9 people coming out.
You don't
out.
Want 9 people coming because
no,
then
when
they
you fly to Wisconsin
again.
To do a gig and there's 9 people there, that's
oh,
very
I remember
sad.
Those. I remember those days. It feels like they were not that long ago. or the room is just totally papered. And those rooms full, you know. You start to get spoiled when people come out to see you on purpose, and then when you get into a room where people don't know you
in LA or something. And
yeah, exactly.
Just, yeah.
That you're a little thrown off because you're like, oh, they don't know me,
right.
So I have to tap dance a little bit, and it's good to do that to remind yourself.
Right,
like,
it is. I had to do that recently. I can't remember what show I was on, but I got up there and I was like, oh yeah, they don't. This is not. These are not my fans. I can't remember where it was, but yeah, it was totally different. You know, you come off the weekend of like a you're at Pittsburgh Improv or something or some theater somewhere, and then they're like, they bought tickets to see you,
right?
And this is like some of these people too. Like, if you can imagine, like you're like, oh yeah, I've been waiting for him to come, and so like they come and they're like, oh, he's here, and then they're happy, so happy, and then you come to LA and you do the Comedy Store, and people are like, oh, this guy.
But it's so,
but for real,
it's so important though. It's so good to have that because I think you know, if you get super spoiled in one
it's
direction,
humbling. You got to be humbled. Yeah,
you well, yeah, and then you also have to remember that you should try. Like if you get too comfortable, where it's like, oh, these people to eat up anything. You don't want you don't want too much of that because then you stop trying and you stop writing. I think you get too comfortable, and I think that's why, you know. I always kind of wonder why a lot of the bigger comics at a certain point just lose their hunger for it. I guess they're just more comfortable with themselves and they don't need approval from strangers anymore, and they're comfortable because they're fucking multimillionaires.
Right.
I don't know what
huge
it is.
Movie stars or something. Yeah, I do think that happens with some of those guys, and that's fine too. You know, and I also think like I don't know, man. Like, there's something about a young comic. That's like, do you remember Bernie Mac's set on Def Comedy Jam, the first set he ever did? Did you ever see it?
Probably, but I don't remember.
There was, he does a line where, can I swear on this or no?
Of course.
He does a line where he says, I'm not scared of you motherfuckers. And he keeps saying that over and over again in the set. And it's because the guy before him on the TV taping got booed off stage.
Oh.
And this was Bernie Mac's like first, I don't know if it's first TV gig or whatever, but he had been, you know, obviously doing really well in the club circuit and all that. And then he came and they were like, yo, it's your turn after this guy ate shit. And then Bernie Mac came on with this attitude where it was like, fuck you. This is what I do.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I don't give a shit if you think I'm funny or not.
Yeah.
But this is what I do and I know I'm funny and it's my turn. I think that established comedians don't necessarily have that feeling.
Right.
Because they don't, they've done it 20 years ago. They had that feeling 20 years ago. Or but that feeling to me, then he starts, you know, Bernie Mac went on stage and he was just like, he did his set. And, you know, the beginning of it was a little rough just because of what happened beforehand. And then he started saying, and then he got a laugh. He said, I ain't scared of you motherfuckers. And that feeling to me, that's that set, if you listen to this, go back and watch it. It's just really special and it's really funny because he has that attitude. You know what I mean?
And that kind of blew him up.
And that blew him up. But that was something to me that older comedians, that they just kind of feel like they did it and they don't need to do that anymore. And you know what? They're kind of right.
Right.
You know, if you know, look at Tim Allen. He still goes on stage. That's awesome. And he does really well. But why does he do that? He doesn't need to.
Right.
He certainly doesn't need to. He does it because he wants to. You know?
Yeah. Well, emotionally, he might need to.
I'm just saying, career-wise, yeah.
I mean, career-wise, yeah, he definitely doesn't need to. But it is, you know, it's one of those things, though, where if you don't kind of pound the pavement to a degree, then you start to lose it a little bit.
Yeah.
So you always – and I think that's where – because I always, you know, I would love to see someone like Eddie Murphy come back and try to do it again. But I think he's just like, what am I going to
do? What is he going to do? I mean,
you get so famous, no one's going to give you the leeway to suck for a while, which you would have to do.
You'd have to. Well, especially he hadn't done it in 30 years, you know? So it's like, or however long it was. How long?
No, it was 30. Well, let's see.
It's 80.
Raw was 86, maybe.
Oh, okay.
Or ish.
Was it that late?
Yeah, Delirious. Because Delirious, I think the first one was Delirious, and I think that was 80, maybe like 82, 83, maybe 84 at the most.
So
and I think
years.
Raw came back 86, 87, I'm pretty sure.
I mean, to me, those two, especially, I can't remember which one, but one of those was my favorite hours. Like that, maybe.
It was probably, I think it was probably Delirious because in Delirious, because in Raw, I think he was a little more, he was a lot cockier in Raw. Because he had already had by that point like Beverly Hills Cop and like he was already fucking huge and Delirious he's still trying and then in Raw I feel like it was still more like it was a little more of the I am holding court now Raw was where he had the blue with the blue leather thing with the gloves. Delirious is when he was in the red leather one and he was still kind of, but you have to remember, I mean, he was probably, when he did Beverly Hills Cop, he was like 24.
Right.
Like he was fucking
so young.
He was 19 when he got on SNL.
Yeah.
So he's, when you think of Eddie Murphy as being this elder statesman of comedy, he's not that old. He's only like 50 something. He's not like 70 years old.
Right. But I always think about like, because what you were saying is he was trying to be funny on the first one. And like as a comedian, well, just even hanging out with people, if somebody's trying to be funny and you see that, you're like, that's not funny.
Right.
Right. So there, you have to have a little bit of, I'm not trying, and this is just kind of me and what's going on, and this is going to be funny.
Well, I think it's,
But what happened with what I think is Bernie Mac, which to me that was maybe my favorite set ever on the Def Jam thing, is that he was still trying, but he was also, he had that attitude. It was like the perfect storm of trying and also not giving a fuck.
I think it's that he. Maybe trying is a weird word because trying makes you think of like trying too hard. Maybe it's just that he really cared about what he was doing.
Right.
He really cared about the craft of it. And he cared about the set and he cared.
I gotcha.
He cared about what he was saying to the extent that he didn't care if anyone else gave a shit or not, because he was just doing it for himself.
Right.
Would you have ever done Def Jam?
I would have loved to have done that. Yeah, I would have loved to have done that. Because that, you know, actually, it came back a few years ago.
Did they bring it back?
But I was way early on in my career. I think I wouldn't have gotten it or done it. But
now.
But yeah, I would love to do Def Jam. Yeah. I always thought that kind of that style was just that in your face is, it's just funny to me. I mean, I still the sets I remember are all from there. You know. Yeah, I love that.
I think it's important to let an audience know that you're not afraid of them, but in a way, I mean, that was a very unique circumstance, and it was sort of like he was kind of backed against the wall a little bit, but it's sort of, you know, how do you gently let an audience know, like, I am not afraid of you, because they don't want you to be afraid of them. They want to know that they can trust you,
because
you're essentially leading them down this kind of emotional journey, and they want to relinquish the control of that, because that's what they're paying for.
Right.
And so you can't, you know, it's in any situation of someone standing in the front of the room and you can tell they're shitting their pants, then you're immediately going to be like, this guy can't lead us.
Right, he's done.
If your pilot comes out before you take off and he's like, I don't know about this, guys, then you're like, I'm fucking getting off this plane. So you really do have to.
And nobody's more hip or smarter to that than black audiences. They just know. They know if you come out and you're not.
Well, they'll also let you know.
Right, exactly.
A black audience will let you know if they think you can, if you can do it or not, which, by the way, is amazing.
Yeah.
Because
it's definitely amazing.
If it's more mixed or if it's more of a white audiences are more like, we shouldn't talk unless someone's really drunk.
Yeah. Of
and
course.
They just, it's not going well with just abject silence, but it's not people like, get the fuck off the stage. Yeah,
right.
Like really where it's like a steeplechase. You know, which I mean, what a great! It's kind of like that in England too, in some of the clubs too, and you know, it just I'm always really interested too in the sort of nature nurture argument of like how a comic develops and it is very environmental, I think.
Yeah.
Because if you kind of have to wrestle with the audience a little bit, that's going to inform how you write jokes.
Sure.
So
definitely.
How did the environment affect you, do you think?
How did what environment being
yours, like the comedy store environment?
I mean, I would get really late spot when I first started. I would get really late spots at the comedy store for about maybe a year. I would get like midnight spots, which would be, you know, when it came up, you know, it was running behind, so it'd be like 11 or it'd be like 12:45 or 1 before I got on stage, and I would have this material and I would be like, these are the jokes I'm going to do, and it would just never work because there would be like 12 people there and it's just not going to work.
Yeah.
And I had to learn that quickly, and I would just then stop thinking about what I was going to do and just be like, look, I am going to be a comedian, which means I think I'm funny. So fuck it. I'm just going to go up with ideas and I'm just going to be funny. I'm not going to try and do material. And that was when I really started to, I feel like for me, like thrive and learn my style and stuff, you know. But that really helped. And then when I would start to get earlier spots, which they were much more packed, but I'd be like, you know, seeing 300 people out there is definitely more daunting than seeing 11 people out there, but it's just as scary. You know what I mean? Like, you're like, still the whole room isn't going to like me if this doesn't go well.
I'm almost more intimidated by 11 people.
Because, in a way it is that way.
Because because number one, it's more difficult for them to come together as a group, which you kind of need for a comedy show, but also when you can really be accountable to individuals in a room.
Yeah, when you can hear somebody, when you can hear somebody's disapproval.
And you can see them because there's only 11 of them in the room. But, you know, you can, in a room of 300, if you can kind of ignite one part of the room, like like you can sort of get a little
lucky. It's less intimate too.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if you're in a crowd of 300 people and you're doing all right and half the people don't like you, then you feel, all right, I kind of got out of it, whatever, it's fine.
Yeah.
But if you have sex with somebody and it's bad, it's very awkward because it's very intimate and there's one person there.
If you have sex with 300 people versus 11.
Yeah.
No, but if you can bring 11 people together, if you can conquer that, like 11 people, I almost feel like it's a bigger feat because it's so much harder.
It is harder. It's a different thing. It's completely
especially
different.
Especially if they're spread out. Like if you go into a room with 11 people and you kind of got to go like, sit together.
Right.
Trust me. Right. Just sit together. It'll be better for all of us if you sit together.
But what's the biggest crowd you've played?
It was probably, I don't know, maybe like 2,000 or 3,000, but I'm about to do this
oddball tour with me.
I'm going to do the oddball tour with you. Yeah. And those were the biggest, the biggest outdoor venues that I've ever
played. Literally, they're on lawns, but I did it last year.
How was it?
Some of them are 20,000 people. And you're out there. And first of all, the first time I did it, I went out there. I think it was in Irvine was the first one I did, the Irvine one. And it was, I think, 16,000 people. And you I got off stage. Literally, you're like, I don't know what 16,000 people laughing really hard sounds like.
Right.
I also don't know what 16,000 people kind of laughing sounds like.
Right.
So you're like, I guess I'm doing well. You know, I don't have a clue. I think this is going well because I hear people laughing. But you know what? It's actually like doing it alone in your bedroom. It's like doing it in your house and nobody's there.
That's how I guessed it would be because it's so isolating, because it's so weird. I think it'd be funny still to be able to pick out one guy way in the back of the lawn and like, that guy's not having fun. Like you still find the one. You still find a guy.
To you, on you saying that, when I got off stage, somebody was like, somebody said, how'd it go? You know, and I was like, I think it went well. And then he said, did you not see, like, they kicked out like six groups of people while you were on stage because they were like being really rowdy and annoying. And I had no idea. I had no idea. Like, you don't even know what's happening. It's so many people.
It is. I mean, I'm excited about it, but I think as a performer, I think 2,000 people is like, if you still want if you still want everyone to feel unified,
because
with that many people,
nah, it's not.
And believe me, I am excited to do it because it's just for the experience. It'll be fun,
it is fun. Yeah,
and I love, you know, like I love the group of comics that are going to be at most of the shows. How many of them are you doing?
I think six or seven.
Oh, okay. But in a group that size, the group dynamics are going to be that, you know, the Loge might be into it, but the front, you know, like, and then those people over there, like it's almost.
I mean, they have people literally walking down the aisles. You guys want ice cream sandwiches? Like, it's like,
and people probably barbecuing on the lawn, and
that doesn't bother you when you're out there on stage.
And then, you know, like a group of people just fingering each other up in the top.
There's a family building a house.
Yeah, there's so many different little pockets of humans that can exist. That I guess, you know, when you're in a club, you can play to like the left half of the room or the right half of the room, but this is like,
no.
How do I lob over this section to get to that one? It's almost like skee ball.
Yeah.
Where you're just like, just aiming.
Yeah. It's quite the experience, but
I don't know. I'm looking forward to it. And I'm looking forward to see, I'm really curious to see how other comics process it and deal with it at the same time.
Yeah.
So, it's going to be fun. I mean, I kind of miss going on the road a little bit because I haven't been able to much because of work, but you know.
But do you feel like, well, how often did you stand up? Because I saw you the other night at the Improv.
Which one? The one?
We were on the same show together at the Improv the other night.
Just a couple weeks ago.
Yeah,
I had a bad show too. I was off.
How often do you do stand up? Like true stand up where you're just doing stand up and not.
Probably.
Like, I mean, you're kind of doing stand up on the
probably
show.
Probably 20 weeks out of the year.
Oh, okay.
You know, and I hit all
that's
of,
a lot, though.
I hit all I mean, of the places yeah. that you would think like.
Oh, so you still stay sharp then?
Well, I try to, but you know, my problem that I had just come off of. I was just somewhere. I was in Portland. I did Salt Lake and then Portland, and then a couple weeks later, I did that show at the Improv. And what I keep saying, I've said this a million times on the podcast, but the hour that I've developed now is all. I developed it kind of as an hour.
Oh.
And so I'm having trouble lifting
breaking
out a 15-minute segment because
it all
like,
makes
there's
sense
a whole
together.
Chunk about my dad dying. And it's like, how do I get into that in 15 minutes?
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
It needs to.
Sure.
And so I went on stage at the Improv and I felt unsure about how I was going to get into some of that stuff. And so it just felt weird and I couldn't, I just couldn't get it on its feet in 15 minutes. So I'm a little nervous about some of these shows, just figuring out like what the chunks are going to be and how to dice them up.
Yeah, that's tricky sometimes. You know, because I was just in Montreal at the Just for Laughs Festival and they want like all those set. I mean, I did my show that was an hour, but all of the shows that weren't my show that they just throw you on, they're like 8-minute sets. And it's like,
it's hard to remember how to do those.
I think I didn't do it good. I don't think I think I failed. Not even bombing. I just think I failed as like a, I don't think I constructed the sets right. Like it was just like, I was like 8 minutes.
Because when you first start out, you're basically building all you do are 5 to 10 minute sets and you build all of your sets are built around a handful of jokes.
Right.
And then when you start doing hours, then your set is built around a handful of chunks or longer, at least for me, longer things.
Yeah.
And so how do you go back? Right. And, you know, it's like I almost kind of feel like I need to write a handful of 8 to 10 minute just, sets that are just for that.
Yeah.
Have you doing another hour anytime
soon? I am. I'm shooting it in December, I think. And but yeah, my first hour came out last December, and it was just kind of, I tried to, you know, thematically make it a theme, but it was still jokes, you know. It was like, this was about this was about that, this was about that, this was about that. And the through line was just like, I don't even remember what it was. But like, when I, now it's more about what you're saying. Like, there it's about something where, like, I'm talking about, you know, do I want to have kids or this and that? And then it's like, that's not just something you can talk about in 2 minutes, and that's too you know what I mean? So right. it's like, yeah, it's trickier, but I'm doing that in December, I think. I'm still picking and choosing what material I'm going to use, but yeah.
How many weeks a year do you go on the road?
Man, now with this Oddball tour, and then I have this other tour coming up after the Oddball tour, I have my tour, which is called Under No Influence, and it's going to be every weekend I'm going to go do something.
Oh, man, that's
for 30 cities.
That sounds amazing, and also kind, I mean, Do you get kind of sad on the road, or
well,
are you good with it?
I would, yeah. I mean, here's the thing. I'm doing all, like, every theater is one night, you know, so it's like,
oh,
I'm not
okay.
in one spot for five days.
So you can't just sit and ruminate
right.
and
that
stew in a
is
hotel room.
A killer. And also, I bring an opener. So if it's just me, and man, I mean, I was just in Pittsburgh for three nights, and I bet I brought an opener. And you know, if I didn't bring him and it was just me, and it's lonely because, like, there, I mean, I don't know, it sounds kind of geeky, but it's like you're just, there's like hundreds of people happy to see you, but you're, and it's almost like a movie. You're like, they don't really know me.
Well, you don't, because most of the day you're just alone with
right.
your thoughts.
Yeah.
And you're just keeping yourself company, and then, and then, you know, you perform and you get at everything you have.
Yeah.
And then the
crowds
home.
Leave.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're like, oh, I guess I'll go.
Who's going to entertain me?
Go back to the Hampton Inn.
Someone entertain me. Go back to the Hampton Inn. Soft beds at the Hampton Inn.
They are. They're great.
I'm telling you.
They are really great.
If you're ever in a pinch somewhere, there are Hampton Inns everywhere.
I totally agree with you.
Yeah. It's Hampton Inns. And then number two, if you can't find a Hampton Inn, Holiday Inn Express has good pillows
oh, yeah.
and nice beds. And then, you know, then there's kind of a steep drop off after that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you get into like the like anything that says motel, that's where you're on
lonely.
Like,
you're super lonely.
Stiff sheets and really small pillows and toilets that aren't bolted to the ground.
Right.
And that can be kind of a bummer. But it is. It is, I love it, but at the same time, I mean, it's nice if you're in a bigger city.
Of course,
like, there's shit
Pittsburgh is
do.
Great, you know, it's a place, but it's like some, I don't know. Well, I played Northfield, Ohio, which is near Cleveland, and they kept on being like, yeah, you're going to Cleveland. I was like, oh, cool, I've been to Cleveland before, and it was not Cleveland. It was, and it was in a casino.
Oh,
and so that's actually
so the best environment.
The best environment and the best environment for comedy.
I mean, seriously, not only the best for comedy, but I find that
just
people are really open.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, and they lose money and they want to just come and laugh about it.
And they're your demo, too. They're not like 70-year-olds.
No. It's
all.
Like the hippest people go to casinos in the middle of Ohio.
So, yeah, I don't know. It feels weird complaining about this stuff because it's great, but
it's not. It's not. I mean, listen. I think overall, if it wasn't amazing, we wouldn't do it.
Of course,
that doesn't mean that things don't have some little things about them. But I'm always curious to know what other people's experiences are because it is. It really is just spending all that time alone. I mean, it is a weirdly isolating kind of a life and sort of a nomadic life, and it's not hard to see why so many comics, like, you know, at one point or another, just drink a shit ton or do fuck tons of drugs or just something to, like, distract, just to come off of the... Yeah.
Well, when you come off stage, especially after two shows, even though you're tired, you know, you're like, it's 11 p.m. and you're like, okay, well, now what? And you're just buzzing. You're like, and there's literally, the audience leaves, maybe you take pictures, maybe you don't, maybe you sign some stuff or whatever, but then they leave with their significant others.
Yep.
And you see how happy they had. They had a great night. And then you're like, and then the manager of the improv or wherever you are is like, you need a ride back or are you going to get one?
I don't know. Like, I don't want to go back to the hotel. Like,
yeah. Ride back where? The fucking Hampton Inn.
Well, you know, they've got a little lobby area with chairs and they got CNN on the TV and a couple microwaves. I mean, you know, like get an apple pie and, you know, yeah. go to the Applebee's across the parking lot. You can just catch it just before our last call.
No, you, yeah, but you guess what? You can't. You can. You always miss it. And you don't have a car. And you don't have a car. And I'll tell you one thing. In Northfield, Ohio, there's no fucking sidewalks either. There's no sidewalks. There's only freeways and no sidewalks. And you have to run. You have to run.
Well, that's why I rent cars in every city.
Yeah, but I don't.
I always
it's
rent
like,
a car. I always
you
rent
have
a
to,
car.
But...
Now we should cue the Loadout by Jackson Browne.
Just hear the. I guess you have to rent a car, but then it's like this is another thing to do that you got to do.
It
you got to return it. You know?
Yeah, I know. You're right. I feel bad. I don't want people to think that I'm complaining about the life that I've chosen. I love doing.
No,
it.
No, but it's fun to complain.
But it's also fun,
especially together.
It's also fun to bond with other people. Like, oh yeah you feel that way too. Yeah. Where you are, it is. You know, like once you're in the green room and everyone's left and you hear the vacuum cleaners go on and all the chairs being put on the tables.
So great.
Know? And then you say to the staff, like, were you guys going anywhere? And they're like, well, I mean, I don't know. We might just drink here for a bit. And then you try to fit in with them, but you don't, you know, you feel you don't know anyone. Yeah, it's a strange, it is a strange existence. It's
There's
such a strange existence.
There are certain things, too, that make me feel especially lonely. And I don't know why, but like there's one thing that people do. And if they recognize you or something on the road, you know, a lot of times when you're in a town, like they're like, you know, if you're in Pittsburgh, like it's not like in Hollywood, you see 70 famous people in a room, you know,
right.
But like if they see you and they notice you from something, and this makes me feel lonely when someone comes up to you and says, Hey, I got to get a picture with you. 'Cause you're like, oh man, it's like you're a thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, they're not... I'm not saying when somebody comes up and says, oh, do you mind if I get a picture?
Oh, right.
I'm not saying that.
Oh, it's when it's very much like, hey, you. Yeah, you.
No, it's beautiful when somebody's like, oh my gosh, can I please get a picture with you?
Right.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
But when somebody's like, yo, we got to get a picture.
It's the same as
that
like,
makes me feel just...
I gotta take a picture with this world's largest hubcap.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. This is the thermometer, the large thermometer.
You, get over here.
Yeah, that makes me feel like sad, dude.
Like, hey, what are you doing here alone?
I don't know. This is the life I chose.
I'm living my dreams, okay? Leave me alone.
Yeah, it's weird the stuff that makes you... Like, I would have never thought that would have been a thing that made me feel like...
Well, some people, they're, and thankfully, I don't know, the people that approach me, I find like 98% of the time are super sweet and very and lovely and you know, but there is every once in a while, it's usually like a drunk guy, and it's always like his friend told him that you were on TV. He's not really sure who you are, but he just feels like he needs to get a picture of you.
This is another thing I was gonna say. Yeah, that was another thing.
I don't know who you are, but
that you're saying that 80% of people are sweet. I would venture to say 70% of people that come up say something backhanded. I don't even know who you are, but these guys say you're hilarious, so
make me laugh. I don't.
Yeah,
that's really funny.
Or when somebody's like, "Oh, this is also one that's just funny. This doesn't make me sad." But when they're like, "Dude, I love your stuff," and you're like, "Oh, cool, thank you," and you're like, "No, like really," and you're like, "Yeah, great, thank you very much." No, because like I don't like stuff. You're like, okay, man, you're just, I don't know, you know, I'm just going to trust you the first time you say it. Like that's...
Or there's an extension of that guy who's like, man, I love your stuff. I don't know what was up with that crowd.
Oh,
but
that's the best.
I was totally into it. And you thought you had a good show.
That's the best. That's
and
the
you're
best.
Like, but I thought it went well.
That happens all the time.
They don't get it, man.
The people I were next to, like, they were like all uptight. And, you know, they didn't laugh once. And I was
what
like, what's
are you talking about? I thought
people?
It was good.
It's so funny. And you feel shitty after that.
Well, they're trying. You know what it is? It's the guy's like, he wants you to know he's on your side.
Yes.
So,
which is sweet.
It's very sweet. And then it is charming. But he's
but you have to remember, I'm insecure.
Yeah.
So when you say that, I hear, oh, I wasn't good.
Yeah, I'm
that
insecure.
Person.
That's why I stand in front of people and try to get attention, okay? That's why I try to get attention from strangers, because I'm obviously trying to validate something, okay? If I had natural validation skills, I would be at home feeling fucking validated, sitting at home.
Absolutely.
Not having to run around like a chimp, like, you know, bouncing around on stage.
Yeah.
But it is, I feel like I am at the point where it is like I genuinely enjoy it and I enjoy the process of it. And I feel like, do you notice now how it used to be so scary to think of being on stage for an hour, and now when you do an hour, you're like, oh, that was an hour? Like, you don't even, it's just like it's an hour before you know it.
Yeah, I think just recently, I've been doing stand-up for 8.5 years, and just recently, it's this past year, I still do this. When they say, a lot of times, you know, if you don't know about stand-up, you're listening to this, like, they'll say, like, when do you want your light? And that means the sound guy will light you, and whenever you want your light, if you want it 10 minutes, you get 10 minutes left. He'll light you, and it means 10 minutes left, right? If you're doing an hour, that means, yeah, give me the light at 50 minutes, right? That's pretty normal. Or, you know, give me a 5-minute light, or give me a 10-minute light, whatever. I always say, give me the light at 35 minutes.
And I ask for 40.
You do?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Because it lets me know that I'm just past.
Over the hump.
I'm over
That's
the hump.
That's what I do. Yeah. That's so funny. Dude.
And it just kind of gives me an idea of like.
I can relax a little bit.
I can relax a little bit and sort of, you know, it lets me know how much time I can fuck around before I get to the last couple
Absolutely.
Of jokes.
That's exactly what I do. Wow. Yeah. I didn't. Okay. That's cool.
Yeah. I get lit at 40. Yep. I'm like, just give me a light at 40 and then we'll just see how it goes from there. Just knowing that, you know, because if you're doing, you know, if you're in a club. Anywhere from 50 to an hour 5 is like right.
It's great.
Right where they want.
And you could you could get away with doing 45 minutes if you're just like, oh my God, this is terrible. Yeah. I hate this audience. I got to get the hell out of here.
Yeah.
So if you're at 35 and I get the light, and I'm like, okay, I could, if it's terrible, if it is.
You only have to get there 10 more minutes.
Yeah. I can do that.
But it.
That's so funny that's how I think though. I'm like, if this is going to be bad, you better just give me a light at 35 minutes.
Well, because a lot of comics like a 5-minute light, or some of them even like a 2-minute. Like if you're doing a short set, it's like give me a minute.
Of course,
give me
of course,
a minute when I'm done a minute. But I kind of, it just gives me a sense of where I'm at. And I really like that. But these, who the fuck's going to light us with 20,000 people? Just like. I think I see a light in the back of the.
That's funny. Yeah, no, it's right at the stage, but they'll just like flash it, and then you, but it's, I think we're doing, or I'm doing like 15 minutes.
I'm doing 15 as well. Yeah. How long's Louis doing? Do you have any idea?
I think 30.
He's doing 30.
Yeah.
Wow.
But when I did it with Chappelle, we would all do like there would be like 4 or 5 guys that did about 15 minutes, and then Flight of the Conchords would go up and do an hour.
Yep.
And then Chappelle would go up and do an hour. It was like a 4-hour show.
I'm surprised Chappelle only did an hour.
Yeah, I know, but it was a 4-hour show.
But it's like a festival at that point.
And it was like, and you know what? The crowds are great, dude. They're like comedy fans. It's crazy. I didn't even know there were that many in cities.
Right.
But they're like people that like some of them love a different, you know, some of them love Chappelle, some of them love Flight of Conchords, some of them come because they love Hannibal Buress or whatever it is, you know, it's like.
Well, you also have, with Chappelle and the Conchords, you have two entities that essentially dropped off the map for a while people love.
Right.
It's like, oh, we get to see, the Conchords came back and Chappelle's doing big venues again. You know, you would always have to go to the Punchline in San Francisco and just be lucky that Chappelle would happen to be there and one night just decide to do 3 hours.
Yeah. And you know, and Chappelle's one of the greats, man. And I sat and watched him in Phoenix when we did that huge amphitheater, and it was awesome, man. It was good. I never watched him for an hour live, you know, and it was great. It's really funny.
I saw him do 3 hours once in San Francisco, and I never thought I could watch someone do comedy for 3 hours, but there's something about him that's so engaging that you, I don't know. I just got sucked in.
Could you personally ever imagine doing 3 hours on stage? I couldn't imagine doing that for me.
No, I don't want to hear myself talk that much.
I just, after an hour, I'm like, okay,
we're good.
I'm done. Yeah.
Yeah, this is good.
Yeah.
But that's a different, I mean, and also not only what I have to do, every decent joke I've ever written.
Oh, I don't even have. I couldn't even do 3 hours. Period. But yeah.
But I'd have. It would just be a lot of crowd work.
Yeah.
Like an hour of material and like 2 hours.
I don't know. Maybe if you have that much material. I mean, it's got to be easier. But
I mean, obviously, if someone said, you know, if there was some sort of a weird cinematic terrorist who was like, "Do 3 hours or I blow this place up," you could do it.
Yeah.
But it's certainly not something that I don't need to marathon perform.
But guys like that, like guys who are that good, guys who I can, you know, like, you know, to me, Bill Burr, Louis C.K., you know, Chappelle, like it's not even about material, really. Like, they just go up and they talk about what they think about, and it's funny.
Yeah, because their machines are so well formed.
Yeah. I always get so jealous whenever I see it. I'm like, oh man, I gotta work hard. It's like, there's no way I want to quit. I'm like,
yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, the guys like that, like the comic right, guys right. who have done, you know, who have performed so much for like 20, 25 years.
Yeah.
That they, you know, they could just start talking about a set of keys,
right?
And it's gonna come out like comedy because right. they are so. I mean, it's like they're like fucking Bruce Lee. Like every motion has been done a million
it's
times.
Crazy,
and they
right?
just know how to.
It's amazing.
It is really. It's fun to watch, and it's fun to watch someone who's that good at anything,
right?
Let alone comedy,
right? Right.
And I love Burr. God damn it, I fucking love that
he's
guy.
He's my favorite right now.
He is so. The thing that I love about Bill is that he will almost force an audience to laugh against their will.
Well, he'll start out with something like, people should get murdered.
Right.
And you're like, well, no, they shouldn't.
No, they should. And then by the end of it.
And by the end of it, you're like, well, yeah, you're kind of right. You know? But really, everything he says is like, you know, like religion is terrible or whatever it is. You know what I mean? Like, what was the thing? Tiger with the one where I thought he's like Tiger Woods cheated. Of course he deserved to cheat or whatever the hell. And everybody was like, oh, what the fuck is he talking about?
You yeah.
know? And women, of course, now immediately hate him.
Right.
But like, but he kills and then
somehow he manages to. It's like he drops the thesis statement, and you go, well, this experiment's not going to work.
Right.
It's not possible.
No.
Like what you've set up. Is there's no, these elements cannot work together.
Yeah.
And then he starts parsing it out and breaking it down. And then he starts to win the audience over. And by the end of it, there, it's like, fuck, he's made a lot of really good comedy points about something that you didn't, that you may not even actually believe, but it's so fucking funny. His attack is so funny that you laugh, you know?
Yeah.
But I'm excited to be on that tour as a fan of the other
people. Just
on.
Yeah, it just feels good to be a part of it, really.
Yeah,
for me. But yeah,
what else do you want to? What are you promoting on Dateable?
Well,
you
my tour, I think, really
you
after Oddball, I'm doing like 6 dates on Oddball, and then after that, I'm going on a tour that's 31 cities, and it's called Under No Influence. It's my tour, and I'm probably coming near you, whoever's listening to this. So go to my website, chrisdalia.com.
Yeah, 31 cities is there's a good chance that you're going to land somewhere near.
Yeah, yeah. I was just they were like, hey, yeah, my agents were like, we think you could do a theater tour. And I was like, I don't want to do it and have it be half full, you know, like,
right.
So it's like, and they were like, no, we think you can do it with the numbers that you're doing in the club. So I was like, okay, set it up. And they were like, yeah, well, here it is. And I was like, okay, 31 cities. That's awesome. And then I started talking to comics and I'm like, well, that's a lot, dude. And I'm like, oh no. Did I do too much?
No. Oh my God. Well, especially if you're going to tape a special in December and you're going to have basically 37 shows mixed in with whatever drop-in sets you do anywhere else. I mean, that's what you need to do to get ready for that special.
And then after I taped my last hour, I was like, I don't want to talk about any of this anymore, ever. People say sometimes, like, you know, because like people will catch up to your old bits and they'll be like, hey, dude, are you going to do this bit? You'd be like, no. YouTube it. Like, I don't even remember it. I feel bad doing it after it airs.
Yeah, because.
For me.
Yeah. Well, and also. When a little bit of time passes, when you hear it again, you're just like, ugh, no, I got new stuff to work through.
Yeah.
And I honestly wish you the best with the tour. I'm actually kind of jealous just knowing that, you know, that by the time I'm jealous in a good way, but I mean, by the time you tape your special, you're going to be so fucking sharp with that hour that it's like the special is just going to feel like effortless.
Yeah. I can't wait. I can't wait to tape it. Last special I did was I didn't do dates before, and I was like, ah, who cares? I'll just do it. It'll be fun. It'll be crazy. Like, it'll be hard. Like, we'll see. And I got through it because I would do, and I realized I just got through it because I was doing a bunch of spots in LA at 20 minutes at a time, and I would just do the section. So I was like, you know, people were like, you're not doing the road? And I was like, nah, I'll be able to do it. Fuck it. But now I really feel like what you're saying, what you said, like there's big chunks and you need to like figure out where, you know, I think that that's important.
Especially if you're in a club, you're more likely to veer off course. But if you're in a theater,
it's much more presentational.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Because in a club, you know, like when you can't help
things
it.
Happen.
Things happen. Right. You interact with people more. But when you're in a club, it's a very presentational version of your set because you can't really talk to people as much.
In a theater.
I'm sorry. Yeah, in a theater, you can't really talk to people as much because it's so big that they can't. It's not as intimate in that way. And so you will really, like, you'll have that hour hammered. I mean, like, 31 Cities is fucking amazing. Are you going to be going back and forth and tape? You must be doing Undateable and then going back and forth.
As it stands now, and nothing's set in stone, but I have a feeling we're going to start shooting in January. So I'll be able to do the tour, do my special, and then start shooting Undateable.
With no break in between.
Right, of course not.
Christmas.
No Christmas. there's a chance we could start shooting early. I have to move some of the dates around, but I think it's pretty set.
And you get to hug Ron Funches almost every day you're at work.
Mm-hmm.
He's so huggable.
He really is so huggable.
He's so sweet.
It's very weird. He's so funny and so sweet.
I mean, I feel like he
kills it on your show.
Fucking crushes. Yeah. I mean, like, I feel like I learned funny things through the course of my life, but Ron's just one of those guys. Like, he's just funny. Like, everything that comes
out. There's people who have the performance aspect of it, and then there's people who are joke writers, and then there's people who are good at excel at one thing, but he's just like, it's kind of unfair. He's just like, he's funny about himself and he writes really well.
Yeah.
You know, and you're like, wow, that's awesome. And you just want to root for him because he's so sweet. You know what I mean? It's like,
I feel like we have to kill him and absorb his essence.
Which is definitely something we should talk about after this podcast.
Oh, shit. Yeah, you're right. Okay, we better wrap it up then. Crystalia on Twitter? It's Crystalia on Twitter?
Yeah, at Crystalia.
All right. Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
What the fuck was that, man?
After a whole hour. I thought it went well.
Hey, man, I don't know what was up with this section of the room, but I thought you did a good job. Like, these guys over here, I don't know.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.